Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hi, and welcome. Welcome to an Hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and we are going to go into the world of the unknown. How does that sound to you for a day's subject matter? Well, I think it's a fascinating one because we're always, in one way or another, affected by the elements around us, and most of us are absolutely enthralled with and fascinated with the unknown universe, which is the title of the book that we're going to be talking about today. Dr. Richard Hammond is my guest. We're going to be talking about the origin of the universe, quantum gravity, dark matter, wormholes. Interested yet? Believe me, I think you'll find a lot of this fascinating. I want to welcome to the show Dr. Hammond. Hello.
Hello, Donna. Thank you.
Well, it is your book. One, I think you've got a wonderful sense of humor. I think you, as a scientist, have such a wonderful, refreshing attitude about a lot of things, and in some respects, you don't even take yourself seriously, which I really loved. But you've published numerous scientific articles in a wide range of fields. You've done everything from relativity to quantum mechanics. You have pioneered a new theory of gravitation that a lot of people are paying attention to, and we'll want to talk a little bit about that. You've won awards from NASA for your research and teaching. You've won international awards for research on gravity. And you were invited to Caltech's Jet Propulsion Lab to study solar system tests of Einstein's theory. You're an adjunct professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. And you work for the Army Research Office as a theoretical physicist. Do you ever have time to play golf?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Do you ever have time to play golf or have any fun? Gee whiz.
Yeah. Actually, I do play a little bit of tennis. So.
A little bit of tennis.
Yeah.
Okay, so you do get away from the science stuff a little bit.
Yeah, but I enjoy it. I mean, I spend a lot of time doing research, and I mean, I enjoy doing physics as much as some people enjoy playing golf, so it's not too bad.
Well, I have a very good friend who has the same kind of attitude. He just absolutely is enthralled with it, and sometimes it's frustrating to him that he can't find people that he can really readily communicate with that are open to new ideas. Mm-hmm. And with your book, you bring forth a lot of challenging questions. Cosmic acceleration is the title of your first chapter. How is it that finally people stepped out of the box of thinking, I'm not saying everybody did, but have come to the awareness that the universe is growing, it's not shrinking? Is it just because we didn't notice it before? What brought this to your attention?
Well, it's we didn't expect it. First of all, people realized since about 100 years ago that the universe is expanding. This was known from looking at the distant galaxies, and they're all moving away from us. That we knew, but we always thought it was slowing down, and that eventually either it might stop or even someday kind of collapse again, and the end of the universe would come, and it would be what we call the big crunch, where everything falls together. That's kind of what we thought for a long, long time. And about 10 years ago, recent observations started to show that the galaxies are actually going away from us faster now than they were 5 billion years ago. By the way, the way we know about things 5 billion years ago, it's not like we have fossil records. But when you look at a distant star, you're looking into the past. So, for example, if you look at the sun, you see the sun 8 minutes ago because it takes 8 minutes for the light to reach us. So if you look at a star a million light years away, you're looking a million years into the past. So anyway, we were able to figure out that very recently that the universe is actually pulling itself apart faster now than ever before, and we have A, no idea why, and B, we have no idea if it's going to keep up forever, and that, you know, the universe will just seem to pull itself apart if this really does continue. So you asked me how I know about it. Well, in the physics community, we publish papers in what we call the technical journals, Physical Review and so forth, things that, you know, people not generally don't hear about, but also sometimes Science and Nature, those magazines. So this was so important, so hot, that at all the conferences I go to and all the conferences, that's the first thing we all talk about. We get in a room somewhere and we'll talk about what it possibly could be, and nobody has a good idea.
That means that there's a lot more for us to learn, and it's sort of like a real-life Star Trek that is evolving, where we're eventually going to be able to explore some things that have been portrayed in a science fiction format for so long, but we are really going to be doing more and more of that exploration, because with our technology, as it becomes more and more sophisticated, we go, whoops, we've got to change this concept and that concept. Is it easy to bring new ideas into the arenas of physics and science when they are against the common norm of
science? No, it's not. As a matter of fact, there's an old quote I discussed somewhere in that book that physics progresses gravestone by gravestone. And what that means is that if you have a certain group of people who develop the ideas we now hold true, then that's what they believe, and often they cannot change. They will not change. They cannot change. If you think about it, that's how they made their living. That's how they've published all their papers on. So they really, really do find it difficult to change. So when you have a new idea or new observations come around, they're often met with disapproval and disbelief. So, for example, maybe 40 years ago, we found out that neutrons and protons, the particles that make up the nucleus, actually they're made up of smaller particles called quarks. And when that was first discussed and even discovered, many, many physicists were against it. Can't be, it's unnatural, it's not true. And then what happens, Donna, is that the evidence just piles up. You know, you do an experiment, you do another experiment, another one, and then there's theory, and then finally when there's enough experiment and theory, then it's like an avalanche, and then people cave in and say, okay, that's the new theory. But these new ideas don't come easy.
No, they don't. You bring up some names of people, like Carolyn Herschel.
Yes.
And you have Vesto Melvin Flicker.
Yeah.
These people. Tell us a little bit about these individuals. I bet you most of the people listening to the show haven't a clue about them.
Well, Carolyn Herschel was kind of a mystery to me. Her brother, Herschel, was a famous astronomer, and he discovered the planet Neptune, and he gets a lot of credit, and it's kind of something that most of physicists, I guess, are aware of. And when I was writing the book, I tried to do some research about him to find out, more about him. And I came across the fact that he had a sister who had apparently a music career and other things. And she gave that up and learned how to make lenses. She learned how to grind the lenses. Nowadays, you buy a telescope.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, you go and get a hunk of glass and you grind it yourself and hopefully to get it in the right shape. And she would do that, and she would do some of the calculations also to figure out where the star was. So they worked together, and she was quite a great assistant, maybe more than assistant. I could never tell. There's not a lot of information about her, at least that I could find out. So, but it's interesting because over the years, women have made significant contributions to science and astronomy. And I don't always think they got their share.
Mm-hmm.
And until recently, I think there was a significant prejudice against them. I think it's fading now, but you never really can be sure if you're a man about that. So, she was very instrumental to that discovery, and the discovery of the new planet was a great event back then.
You pose questions, little quizzes throughout your book that I had a lot of fun with.
Oh, great.
Enjoyed them. And I thought that, along with your little commentaries afterwards, which often had a great deal of humor to them, were so interesting. Vulcan. Now, there isn't a soul that has not been aware of Star Trek that isn't aware of the planet Vulcan.
Right, right.
But that, I didn't realize that it is the planet closest to the sun. How come we don't know anything about this?
Well, you know, I had that notion in my mind. And again, when I did the research for the book, I found out that not only was it postulated to exist because Mercury was not moving in the right orbit, and they thought maybe there was another planet. But not only did they postulate it, but that it was observed, and by Le Corbusier, the French doctor. But what happened was after, and the reason why nobody else saw it, perhaps, was because it's so close to the sun. And it's difficult that the closer it is to the sun, it's the more difficult it is to see because the sun blinds it out. So, but it turns out that in 1915, Einstein's general theory of relativity, his new theory of gravitation, accounted correctly for the motion of Mercury, and then Vulcan was not needed anymore. So, and then it was never seen again. So in reality, there is no planet Vulcan, but for a while, there was, you know, the belief that it did indeed exist.
Oh, boy. Spock fans are going to be very disappointed. Okay, let's talk about the Hubble telescope. And let's talk about Hubble himself. Because when he came up with his concept, that caused a real furor, didn't it?
Oh, yeah. That was one of the biggest... It's hard to explain how big it is. We know now, as I mentioned before, the universe is expanding. But before Hubble, it was always believed that the universe was a great big, basically static thing. Although there were local motions, like the Earth moving around the sun and so forth. But on the whole, it was this big, vast sea of infinite sameness, so to speak. And it was so deeply entrenched in our thinking that Einstein actually went about changing his equations, his famous equations of general relativity. He went back and he changed them so that they could handle a static universe. And, I mean, that's just... And look how smart Einstein is, right?
Mm-hmm.
One of the smartest
mm-hmm.
people we ever had. But even he was unable to let go of this concept that the universe was static. And it's kind of ironic. He didn't really hear what his equations were telling him. They were telling him, Albert, listen, the universe is not static. It's not. It's expanding. And but others, however, did look at the mathematical possibilities. And then with Melvin Vesto Slipher, or Slipher, I'm not sure how to say it, with his observations and then with Hubble, they realized that every distant galaxy was moving away from us, and the further away, the faster it was going. And the only way to account for that was that the universe was expanding. And this was in the years in the 1920s. So by 1920, where everybody had this firm belief of a static universe, there was this revolutionary change. By 1930, we knew the universe was expanding, and that just completely... You know, that just completely changed our views. If it's expanding, is matter being created? Where is the matter coming from? Are we getting further apart? And there were just all kinds of questions. But, you know, now we understand how it works. But it was quite a revolutionary concept.
With Hubble's telescope, it has just brought us into a whole new perceptiveness regarding the universe. And that continues to expand. Again, as we become more aware of how we can use technology to do our exploration, whether it's with robots or something else, and send the information back, we are just being just absolutely shocked out of our complacencies on so many levels. But as you said earlier, it's really tough to make the breakthroughs because the establishment is there and it doesn't want to shift. Dark matter, that sounds so wonderfully mysterious. And
yes.
Let's talk about dark matter, and then a gentleman that you mention in here, and I just had it, I missed Kepler. Let's talk about those two people. Give us a little bit of insight to them, or those two items, rather.
Okay, sure. Kepler, Johann Kepler, one of his most famous discoveries was that he figured out a relationship between the period, that means how long it takes a planet to go around the star, and its distance. So it's called Kepler's Law. So with Kepler's Law, if you know the distance, you know how long it takes to go around. And, well, that was, first of all, that was a great discovery. And this was really the beginning of modern science. His predecessor was Tycho Brahe, who had this great observatory in Denmark. And Tycho Brahe did not have telescopes. They were not invented yet. When Johann Kepler went there, he brought with him telescopes, and he was able to make the discovery I just mentioned, and also that the planets go around in elliptical orbits. So this was the beginning of modern astronomy, and then Isaac Newton was able to prove that the planets go around in elliptical orbits. So you remember before I said it takes usually both observations or experiments and theory, and when they both match, then we feel like we understand something. Well, back to the 1920s now, when people were looking out at different galaxies, they noticed that they were trying to figure out the mass of the galaxy. And to do that, you measure the speed of the outside stars in the galaxy. And through Kepler's law, you can deduce the mass. So this is how they're related. Although Kepler used his laws to relate the distance of the planets from the sun and the mass of the sun, in the 1920s and 30s, the astronomers used the same law, Kepler's law, but this time they applied it to galaxies, where they looked at the outermost stars, figured out how fast they were going, and then from that deduced the mass of the galaxy. However, the number they got was much, much, much bigger than the amount of mass they could see. I mean, you could see light, and you could, from the galaxies, and you could say, well, on average, there are going to be, you know, so many stars like our sun, and therefore you can add up from the amount of light, you can figure out how much mass there is. But the trouble is, these two methods were totally different. The measuring the speed using Kepler's law turned out to give a mass 10 times bigger than what we saw. So the outer stars were moving way too fast. It's just that there was, in order to account for that speed, there had to be 10 times as much matter as we see in a galaxy. But so that's why we call it dark matter. It's a pretty apt name. We think it's there. I mean, we don't really know for sure, but we think it's there, but we can't see it. It's not just the fact that we can't see it. You know, we look at many different wavelengths. We look at the infrared region, which is like heat. We look at the ultraviolet region. We can see X-rays, the kind you get when you go to the dentist. And through all these spectra, there's no evidence at all of the dark matter. So we've never seen it. We've never detected it. But it is felt it must be there because there's no way otherwise to account for the outermost stars, the speed. Unless, of course, you say that the theory of gravity is wrong. But that's a possibility, but let's put that aside for the moment and just go with, if we assume our theories are right, then we have a great, great mystery, because 90% of all the matter in a galaxy is invisible. And that, you know, we're a typical galaxy, the Milky Way, so that means we're filled with dark matter too. And if it's 10 times the amount, I mean, that's an enormous amount. For every Earth, there's 10 Earths worth, or 9 Earths worth of dark matter. So where is it? I mean, we don't see it. We don't see it in the backyard. We've been more careful than that. We've tried to do experiments to look for it. You kind of guess what it might be, and then you design your experiment around that. And we've been working on this now for 30 years, and there's absolutely no evidence that we ever found dark matter. So this is the great problem. This is one of the biggest problems. It's hard to say which is the biggest unknown. In my book, The Unknown Universe, I try to hit the 9 or 10 biggest unknown problems, and the expanding universe, the accelerating universe, is one of them, and a big one. And the other one, maybe just as big is or problematic, is this dark matter. We know it must be there. We have no idea what it is, and we've never observed it.
Oh, that's exciting to me. Think of how much work you've got ahead of you.
Yeah, I'd look at it that way, too. I like your attitude, Donna. It's a positive thing. It's something to look forward to. And I kind of try to weave that notion into the book. And I talk about in the past when there were problems. I say, you know, it's a great time for theoreticians like me where we can unleash our imaginations and try to figure out what's going on. So I agree with you. It's great fun. But it is perplexing, though, because it seems to be such a hard problem.
Well, I think that's what creates progress, is if we keep our minds open and say the what ifs and just keep looking and, again, being willing to have the adventure of changing things that maybe other people don't want to be changed, because then that gets a little scary. I find that when I'm interacting with people, and I'm not anywhere near your level of brilliance with science, and it's really fun to me to see how many people will say, that's okay, let's keep it make-believe, because if it becomes a part of the real world, it means that I'm going to have to change. It means I have to change my mind, my thinking, and that obviously has to do with perception. It really is a challenge to every generation. And I think people like you, the more that you're around young people that have a love of science, that you can imbue this sense of curiosity into and then shared with them and get them excited, then the more chance they have to survive off in the bureaucratic environment that says, don't give me that. We've got 5,000 more grants that have to come through this month. Let's not get imaginative here. We're going to be practical.
I hope so. I agree with you. And I hope so. But, you know, that's a large part of the reason I was excited about writing this book, too, by realizing that there's a lot of unknowns and that we need a lot of research. I think, you know, and I weave that through the book too, the idea of actually funding research. But I think what you're alluding to is a very good point. Is it goes beyond just physics. I mean, there are unknowns in all forms of life, and they should be embraced. And if there's something that's unknown or you don't understand, then it's a good thing to go. And look at it and not say it's make-believe, but to actually investigate it, keep an open mind, look for the interesting things. We have a long way to go. You know, I point out somewhere in the book, I mentioned the fact that we've been doing science now for just really a modern science for a couple of centuries. And the sun will last 5 billion more years. So if the Earth makes it through that, and if we make it through that, and we have a tremendously long way to go of learning. And it's like, by a comparison, how much we've been studying, how much time we have to go, is like going to kindergarten for 2 seconds and quitting.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you can see by analogy how much the enormous amount of knowledge we have out there that we have yet to learn.
Oh, yes, and how much of it is going to be ending up in the wastebasket. But that's the way it goes.
Yeah.
It really does go that way. Let's talk about a particle, the Higgs particle. I've never heard of this. And you ask a question right at the beginning of that title. Consider the nucleus of any atom consisting of protons and neutrons. Does this also have quantized energy levels, and does it emit protons during a transition? And my audience is listening to this and saying, Donna, for heaven's sake, would you get real here? We don't know about this stuff. Now, you posed these questions. And the answer could be no, it is too small, yes, but they're invisible, no, quantum mechanics only applies to atoms, not to nuclei, yes, that's where we get gamma rays, and actually two of those were correct. Tell us about this Higgs particle, and why is it so important?
Okay, I will, but I'll also mention that although that sentence sounds pretty physics-y, it really flows from the previous chapter, and if a person were reading the book, I think that would not be so mysterious. But anyway, the point is that we know all the particles, neutrons and the protons and even the electrons, have mass. For example, if we step on a scale, we weigh so much, that's because we have mass,
mm-hmm.
8 kilograms or whatever it is. And in theoretical physics, we try to understand how particles interact. And to understand how particles interact, we have to give them a mass. And it turns out, it's just the way we do our theories. We have to, they get a mass through a mechanism called the Higgs particle. I mean, like, in a bad analogy, if you say, you know, how do you have paint on your house, you have to go through a mechanism of getting a brush and spreading this liquid that becomes hard, and then you have a painted house. So we know how to paint a house. We have the procedure, and it's something everybody can understand. Now, in physics, we have to give particles a mass, and we have a procedure. And that procedure is called the Higgs mechanism. So it's not quite as easy to understand as dipping a brush in a can and spreading it, but nevertheless, that's how it works. So, and we know all of these particles have mass, so we know there must be this Higgs particle, then everything, the theory works. But here's the trouble. If there is this Higgs mechanism, then there's a Higgs particle, and we've never observed the Higgs particle. That's the big problem. There must be a Higgs particle because every single other particle in the universe acquires its mass through the Higgs mechanism. By the way, this is named after Peter Higgs, a theoretical physicist. So anyway, there must be the Higgs particle, yet after 30 years of searching for it, we haven't seen it. And this is, again, one of those really, really big problems. And if we ever do find it, then everybody will know about it. It'll be on the front page of the New York Times. It'll be on the magazine. The Higgs particle is found. It'll be, and they'll have kinds of explanations about it and so forth. But I mean, that's the thing. It's one of those. It just has to be there, or all our theories are wrong. And if all our theories are wrong, then we're really in trouble. But we haven't seen it. So how can that be? How can there be a particle that must exist that we haven't seen? Well, one answer is it's too massive. E equals mc squared tells us that if it has a lot of mass, the m in mc squared, then the E, the energy, it takes a lot of energy to make it. However, through other kinds of analysis, we know how we have an upper limit. It can't be more than about 1,000 times the mass of a proton. It can't be more than that. And it can't be less than, we have another lower limit. So we have it bounded. So we know, you know, somewhere in there what its mass should be. And we're looking every single day, you know, in these giant accelerators that we built. Some of them you could put a town inside. And we smash nuclei into other nuclei. We smash atoms together. One of the things we're doing is looking for the Higgs particle, and we're getting closer to running out of room, so to speak, because we're almost at the point where we've searched through all the energy levels we think it could exist. But you see the problem, Donna. Here it is. Our total understanding is based on the Higgs mechanism, and that's what gives particles their mass. Yet we haven't found the Higgs particle, which must be there. So it's a kind of a scary or exciting time to be, because in a few more years, either we're going to find it, or we're going to say it doesn't exist, and then all kinds of trouble comes along. So you see how exciting yet scary that is.
Well, I think that it is perception, because when you are in science, you're always going to be the explorer. And there will be those things that may, for a period of time, seem as an absolute, and then something may come along, liquefy it, dry it up, blow it away, because something else will come in because of the expansion of our understanding and the fact that the paradigms do shift and change as we become more and more aware. You go into your book, The Unknown Universe, you talk about curved, two-dimensional space. You talk, in fact, you've got a snapshot of space-time and its movement. You go into so many different aspects of science that, again, I have to say, Star Trek fans of the world, you need to get this book, The Unknown Universe. Gene Roddenberry was ahead of his time, that's all I can say, because you guys are bringing a lot of stuff, and I know I'm being a little sassy when I'm saying that, but I really mean it, because there are so many things that these, sometimes people bring out Arthur C. Clarke in much of his fiction, and so much is a stimulus often to explore and to question, and you've been involved in gravitational research, and we didn't have a chance to get into that, but that is an arena. I mean, I fully expect that one day there's going to be this transport vehicle out into space, and everybody's going to be walking upright. The bones are going to stay fine, and their heads are going to stay on their shoulders perfectly normally and naturally. So let's have your website, because, Dr. Hammond, you've just got so much wonderful information in this book, and believe me when I say this, I am not in any way close to being a theoretical physicist. I wouldn't even attempt to go there, but I thoroughly enjoyed your material. I really did.
Thank you, Donna, and it seems to me that you've got a lot from your questions. You really got a lot out of it, and you really understand a lot of the things I was talking about, so I'm very happy with that. And the other thing is, I have a website, www.theunknownuniverse.net, and I have an Ask the Author section. So if anybody wants to ask questions about the book, or even not about the book, you can just go on that webpage, theunknownuniverse.net, ask me the question, and I'll try to answer it.
Great. And for those of you that have kids that are in school, wow. Here you've got a direct link to someone that has a passion for science and for learning and for exploring the unknown universe. That's the passion of his life. It would be great. Put your kids in touch with him. If they've got a science project or whatever, they're going to find a lot of material on his site. Dr. Richard Hammond, PhD, his wonderful book, The Unknown Universe. He talks about quantum gravity, wormholes, all kinds of goodies, some of which we discussed today. It is a good read. Dr. Hammond, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you, Donna. It was good to be with you.
This is Donna Siebel. We're taking a break. Don't go away. We've got other good things to share with you. We'll be right back.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyMD.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Siebel on her show on bbsradio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna Siebel, and I wanted to let you know telephone lines are open. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. If you'd like to call in and chat with me, I'd be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. It's this easy. Here are the toll-free numbers you can call in to. They are 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Also, Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And we have a direct line of 530-876-3222. Now, if you're a first-time listener, just know all I need from you is your first name or your initial, and then after that, I'll give you my mental impressions. I consider myself an information resource, and I'm delighted to share that with you on the air. And then after I finish giving you my insights, then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you would like to ask about. Animal, vegetable, mineral, it doesn't make any difference. Well, I know we've got a caller on the line. Let's go to that caller. And what's your first name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Denise from Tucson.
Hi, Denise.
Hi.
Okay, Denise, what I am looking at with you is you're going to need to really make some very careful assessments when it's coming to money. There are a number of, it's like I'm seeing, let me back up for a minute. It is as if I am looking at an eight-hole sieve, and it's as if any money that would come in could go out through those holes in the sieve so quickly that you wouldn't have a chance to build up any kind of a reserve. And I think you are going to have to close one or two of those holes so that you can have a reserve that you start working with so that you can eventually then be in a situation where you, one, will have a cash backbone of a type to work with, and two, that will enable you to make some of the changes that you want to make for yourself in location. But that's going to take some time. And it could take you about 2 years to be able to acquire all of the dollars that you would want so that you could do whatever you needed to do for yourself. And I am looking at a potential of a relocation that will come about within the number two. It's not 2 days, it's not 2 weeks, and I don't think it's in 2 months. I do think there is this relocation, though, that is evolving. And when you make the choice for the relocation, it will be directly related to an economic opportunity for you. So there is a big picture of money around you on multiple levels, and it seems that you have to become more knowledgeable about how to manage it so that you are going to have what you want. What question would you have for me today?
That's exactly why I was calling you, to see what you picked up for the month of July and August as far as money situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, again, that there are those holes in a sieve, and I'm only seeing eight. So when I'm looking at that, to me, that's just representative of many different things getting away from you. And that's something that you have to look at very, very carefully, and have to ask yourself some very honest questions. And if you do that, then I think you're going to be okay. I think you're going to be on stable ground. But if you don't do that, then you're going to find that you don't have an extra penny in your pocket, and that's not where you want to be.
Okay, so it sounds like I need to tighten my belt.
Mm-hmm. I'd say so. At least two of those holes in that sieve should be plugged up. Whatever they represent, I don't know. I'm not getting those specifics at this time.
Okay. Well, thank you.
You're very welcome, Denise. Have a wonderful day. And a happy 4th, by the way.
Happy 4th.
Take care, dear. Donna Sebo here. And if you'd like to talk to me, as Denise just did, give me a call at 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. I have to tell you, I am so excited about an upcoming activity. And for those of you who are listening that are in the state of Washington, you need to know about the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair. Now, I have been involved with this event annually. Goodness, it's either my 6th or 7th year. I absolutely love doing it, primarily because I love to dress up. And, of course, you can come up with any kind of costume you want, and it's just as if you get to step back into time. So I am a person that participates in this, and of course in doing it I am interacting with all kinds of people, but it's so magical. Now this year, the Washington Renaissance Fair has a new home, and it is in Belfair, Washington. And I'm here to tell you, because I was out there today, it is one of the most beautiful sights you could ever imagine. It is totally, totally magical. And if you've been to the Renaissance Fair in the past, believe me, you must not miss this year. This is their new permanent site. Now, the weekends that this event is being held are the first 3 weekends in August. The dates are August 2nd, 3rd, 9th, 10th, 16th, and 17th. It is one of the most wonderful events for family. It is just absolutely awesome. Parking is free. Parking is free, and it is close for those of you that are going to be in the Seattle area. You can just take a ferry over. They have a shuttle that runs every hour on the area, hour from the ferry itself into the site. and it is glorious. As I said, I was out there today, and I am so excited. It is going to be like a magical fairyland. By the time they finish, they have these wonderful knolls that you walk through. They have vendors put in all kinds of different places. They have got stage settings that are going to be going up in just a couple of weeks. I mean, this is absolutely gorgeous. Now, again, this is in Western Washington, and the site is right off of Northeast Bear Creek, DeWatto Road. Now, I'm not going to give you the directions there, but if you'll go to their website, Washington Ren Fantasy Fair. That's the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair.com. It'll pop up right away on Google. And just go in and you'll find out all the information. You'll get the ticket information, everything else. I'm going to be out there in a booth. Look for the bright red yellow banners with the gigantic red lions on it. And that's where I'm going to be. So be sure if you have a chance, come on out. But do come out. It is an awesome, awesome event. And I'm going to be talking about it now all the way through August because it is something that is super spectacular. It is going back in time into medieval times. You'll see jousting knights, all kinds of activities. So I'll be telling you more as we go along. We'll even have the opportunity to chat with some of the people that are going to be there in the coming weeks, and it is a marvelous event. Again, this is the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair. Go to their website, and you'll be able to find out all the information you could ever possibly want to know. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you would like to chat. I'm going to be delighted to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. And, again, just give me a buzz at 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756. Now, tomorrow is the 4th of July. I just had fly over my office here in the Seattle area, some phenomenal bluebirds. They're on display because we have a very special event that's going to be happening for in celebration for the 4th of July. So the jets are out there flying, and I'm sure wherever you are, there's just all kinds of activities. But tomorrow the show's going to be live. It's going to be an open mic show, and I invite you. If you're going to have the day off and you're out barbecuing, just turn on your computer, or if you just want to sit back and relax and have a little bit of fun, just go ahead and enjoy what we've got, because we're going to have all kinds of odds and ends of good things, good recipes to share, and other things, too, on the 4th of July. Are you a procrastinator? Well, I think we all are, aren't we, at one time or another? Boy, when we're tired, we just have a hard time getting up and getting going. Well, I've known some people that seem to really, really have a problem with it. And Julie Raymeier had some perspectives regarding procrastination that I thought that, in fact, she says, if you're an unapologetic procrastinator running fast and furious up to the deadline and often right past it, it is not that you choose to turn work in late, but rather that you have no choice, you say. Well, apparently somebody has gotten into the mathematical side of this. Don't ask me why, but that's what they've done. And they decided they were going to plot procrastination habits on a graph. And what they discovered is that the speed of a procrastinator's work is a straight line rising as the deadline gets closer. Well, I could recognize that because I know of someone that does exactly that. They wait until the very last minute to do anything, and then they're frantically rushing around, and it's amazing to me that they even get it done. Now, there's a computer science professor, Michael Bender, who, in observing this, and he's with Stony Brook University in New York, used this line on the graph to calculate the time it might take a real-life procrastinator to complete a series of tasks using various strategies that most of us would use, but especially focusing on the most important, if not necessarily the most eminent, the deadline first. Now, his analysis was published in the Journal of Scheduling, showed that no strategies guarantees that procrastinators will meet all deadlines. I know of a guy who procrastinated so badly he flunked in college because he was always late on everything. The irony was is that the professors often gave him an A on his thesis or whatever he was presenting. They'd say if he had turned it in on time, instead of getting a D minus or, you know, or an F plus, whatever, you would have had an A. hard habit to break. Procrastinators wait to work while when an unexpected assignment becomes a new priority thanks to someone else maybe not getting their work done. The typical procrastinator has no slack time and will blow their deadline. To meet all their deadlines, Bender says, procrastinators have to be able to see the future perfectly. But they don't need a crystal ball. Timothy Pickle, a psychologist at Carleton University in Ottawa, Ontario, has a different view of it. He says procrastinators need discipline. Procrastination happens because you're disorganized, not very dutiful, and probably impulsive. Different perspectives on procrastination. I still don't quite get the mathematical side. To me, if you're a procrastinator, you're a procrastinator. And again, we all do it at one time or another. This is Donna Sebo. We're going to take a break. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756 or 530. 876-3222. We'll be back in just a moment.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com. and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Hi, this is Donna. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227, 888-815-9756 or 530, 876-3222. Now, by the way, I want to let you know who's coming up next week. We're going to be talking about bicycling beyond the divide. Daryl Farmer on Monday, we're going to be talking with. If you're a person that loves the outdoors or you want to listen to a story about an adventurer, try a guy that is middle age and decides to do a bicycling route that he did when he was in his 20s. It's really good stuff. It just gives you a whole different perspective of adventure on a bicycle. So we're going to be talking with him on Monday. We're going to be talking also about green home dwellings for the 21st century. Green homes, green everything is very popular today. Why? Because we're becoming more environmentally conscious. Well, Ashley Rooney is going to be my guest, and this is a woman that has done quite a bit of study on this with architects, etc., and it's exciting what we can do in our homes to make a difference. Then we'll be talking with Jay Holt, Tommy to Tomato, this is stuff for kids we're going to be discussing, and then on Thursday, Alan Davidson, his book is Body Brilliance. This is a man who turned his life around to become a living demonstration of how you can go from something very vile, very ugly, into something quite beautiful. And then Merle's Door. We're going to be talking about a man and his dog. This is a fabulous, fabulous publication, and if you love animals as much as I do, you're not going to want to miss it. Great lineup. Just remember, at BBS, we have a listing of all the guests that are upcoming, and you can be in touch with us and to find out what it is that's going on. Also, my newsletter has gone out, so if you would like to get a free copy, all you have to do is go to my website, DelphiInternational.com, and you'll be able to download it, find out who's coming up, learn about a great recipe, and just some real neat stories about good people. Well, if you're interested in saving money, gracious, who doesn't want to save money? We all want to save money. Well, I came across some information that I thought I would share with you today because we can always find out maybe something on one level or another that would be of interest to us that would enable us to save pennies. I talked with a caller earlier regarding money, and there's just little things that you can do. Well, how many of you go out shopping? I plead guilty to this one. You go shopping for all kinds of different items. Maybe they're practical things, maybe they're not, but you buy the big box. Or if you, like I've done in the past, sometimes you'll see a deal on potatoes and you'll buy 50 pounds of potatoes. Well, if you really look sometimes at doing things like that, maybe it would be more cost-effective for you, unless you have a family of 12, 20, to buy things of smaller size. I know we've got a caller on the line. Let's get to the caller, and I'll have some other tips to share with you as well for saving money if we have the time. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Don from Carmen, Idaho.
Hi, Don. Carmen, Idaho. We're going to be talking about Idaho a little bit on Monday. It's a beautiful state. Absolutely beautiful.
Thanks.
Okay, Don, the first thing that I'm looking at with you is you are slowly but surely taking the what I call the scales off of your eyes. You are getting past a point of apprehension that you've had to reach the positioning of self-confidence that allows you to look at things without being apprehensive. Again, it's like I see fish scales coming off your eyes. So you're going to be able to perceive information that for you is going to be invaluable. That is going to be something that is going to serve you quite well. You're moving forward slowly but surely in the direction that you're having and desiring to really manifest in your life what is most meaningful to you. Keep up your writing. If you choose to upgrade to a computer, I'd encourage you to upgrade to a laptop where you will be able to use, now the term just went right out of my head, those little units where you can put a couple of gigabytes or terabytes on them and, you know, download everything into that so that it doesn't overload your computer.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like for you to have something that's portable because you need to have that sophistication, and I'm even seeing you have a cell phone that allows you to link up with your computer,
mm-hmm.
and it's portability for you. That is so important. You don't need mega anything in the way of size. You need something that's going to move with you wherever you want to go. Trip overseas to Europe that is going to be coming up, and I think economically you're leveling yourself out. So you're feeling comfortable, and that is a very good thing for you to do. You've had a pretty rocky road the last 6 years. You've had a lot of upheavals. But you're coming into your own, so be patient with yourself. You're doing a pretty good job. What's on your mind, Don? What did you want to ask me quickly?
Oh, well, real quickly, I'm actually, in my career, I'm actually very successful at what I do, but I'm also very bored.
And so
I was looking at maybe making some kind of change.
Well, the change is going to be coming, and I do know that portability for you is important in whatever you use in the way of technology. You have to be able to be mobile.
Well,
that is going to be very important for you.
Yeah, I actually do have a laptop along with a desktop. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think you're going to be upgrading to some even more sophisticated technology, which is not a big surprise. I think that's very natural for you. But it's really going to be such an asset for you on so many levels. But you're going to be able to make the change. Give yourself time because you are beginning again to see things differently than you have ever before. And that's because you have the level of self-confidence that you've grown into relative to being able to make a change.
All right. Thank you.
You're doing well. You just keep it up. Just be patient.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Don. This is Donna Siebel. We're out of time. And, hey, tomorrow's the 4th of July. Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, have a fabulous, fabulous safe holiday. And don't forget, take care of your animals. If you've got dogs and cats, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, be sure you have them in a place that's safe where they're not going to be put under undue stress. This is Donna Siebel. We'll be back here tomorrow, same time, same place. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. This is Donna Siebel. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Siebel Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Siebel Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program.